about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Davey Wanton, and we'll be answering your most important questions on midge presentation. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Davey Wanton about midge presentation. At flyfishtv.com, all of Davey Wanton's insightful DVDs and streamed videos are available. Along with Midge Magic Fishing and Midge Magic Tying, you'll find Davey's classic, Wet Fly Ways, Wet Fly Tying, and Fly Tying Fundamentals. Few others are as sharp on the water and at the vice as Davey. To learn more about his home river, the White, in Arkansas, go to the Rivers section, where you'll also find titles on the Madison, Henry's Fork, and Snake Rivers. Check out flyfishtv.com for any of Davey's titles. Before we introduce Davey, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Dying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And look for the link under Davey's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Davey's two DVD set, Midge Magic Fishing and Tying, produced by Flyfish TV. So here's how you can win that two DVD set. You need to be the first person to answer the question or questions we ask at the end of the show. The questions will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely during the show, take good notes, and type fast, and you may be able to win that two DVD set. Our guest tonight is Davey Wanton. Davey's interest in fly fishing started way back in the 50s when he watched his first trout caught by a fly fisherman. To say he was hooked was an understatement. His professional career began in the early 1960s as a professional fly tier, moved on to manage a mail order business, developing and manufacturing both fly tying and fly fishing products, one of which was the world famed SLF series of dubbings. He began writing fly fishing articles in the early 70s and continues to do so. Many of his fly patterns are currently produced commercially for the world market. He is a consultant to many of the fly fishing organizations around the world. This past 5 years, working in conjunction with Flyfish TV, has produced a number of shows for national networks, along with his own series of how-to DVDs. This past August, he shot a further DVD related to stillwater fly fishing and techniques in Montana. Davey was recently awarded in Atlanta the USFW Director of Fisheries Award for outstanding voluntary services towards fisheries and conservation for services rendered. He is a popular speaker at fly fishing events around the country and hosts many other fly fishing activities during the year. He will tell you that there is no finer place to be than on the water fishing, and despite his professional workload, he still finds time to do that. His credits for the White River amount to catching a brown trout 25 pound 6 ounces, a cutthroat 6 pound 4 ounces, a rainbow 8 pound 2 ounces, and a brook trout 2 pound 12 ounces. Well, Davey, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. Look forward to the program this evening.
Well, good, good. Good to have you back. Let me see
Thank
if I
you.
Can boost your volume here a little bit. Okay. So hopefully that'll be better. And had a little trouble getting you connected, but we got you now, so we're all set to go. All is good. And we can dive in on midges. I guess the first thing to talk about, because I think you have a larger scope when talking about midges, so why don't you define for us what you consider midges when we're talking about midge presentation?
Yeah. I guess most anglers, their definition of midges really as a relationship more to coronids, which are extremely predominant in tailwater systems. But I generally don't look at it that way because midges, by definition to me, are small flies. It doesn't matter whether they're waterborne organisms or they're terrestrials, whether they're mayflies, whether they're microcaddis. Midges are midges. In other words, by definition, small flies. In many respects, the approach, the presentation values required, and the means or method to fish and to catch fish, when they're to a large extent kind of slacked up on taking very small organisms, pretty much amounts to the same. There is obviously a difference in the choice of flies, but by and large, presentation values and needs, methods of presentation and fishing those flies are the same.
So really it sounds like the preparation and the presentation are going to be the big changes that we're going to be talking about tonight from other types of nymph fishing and surface fishing, dry fly fishing. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
We did have a question here from Bob Carpenter in Connecticut. He says, the midges serve as a viable food source, even for the population of very large wild browns that are prevalent in the White River. And so I guess a lot of people think that big fish don't eat small flies. So you want to dispel that myth?
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, some of the largest brown trout I know that have been caught on very, very small flies. I think the one thing that matters more than anything else is that there has to be a predominance and or an abundance of that particular species, whatever it may be, in that water system that obviously gets the fish's awareness to that food source, and obviously thereafter they take an interest to eat those items. But yeah, no question or doubt about it. It's a misconception that big fish just won't eat small flies. That's far from the truth.
So what you're saying is they really need to be on the feed get them up to get to those small flies. In other words, we got a big brown trout sitting under the bank. He's not going to come out 5 feet to get a midge. He's got to be out there already feeding on them.
No, that's not true either. Because many of the large brown trout I have caught, particularly in very slow, clear water, where obviously, you know, you just make one bad mistake and boom, they're gone. Odds are, you know, you can fish a very, very small fly and they will come out and take that. I'm not saying they're going to do it every time, but there's still an opportunity to catch very big fish fishing very, very small flies if, as I said previously, they have somewhat of an awareness to the fact that those waterborne organisms exist in that water system and are there in some abundance. So
right. That
would not necessarily be true, that they have to be actively seen to be feeding on that source before you have a chance to catch them on a small artificial fly.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of questions here on equipment and fly lines and leaders and tippets and all kinds of terminal tackle. And I think that is, you know, from what you've told me already and watching your DVDs, that is truly important in the setup. So let's dive into that. Boris in Ohio, wants to know what's your favorite rod and terminal tackle for midge fishing in moving water. We can break down the terminal tackle, but why don't you talk about rod, reel, general line characteristics that you prefer?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Insofar as midge fishing is concerned, bear in mind that generally speaking, you're going to fish light tippets. 6X, 7X, 8X, and in extreme cases, maybe finer than that. So bear that fact in mind, you need a rod that can accommodate, you getting good presentation values, i.e. that is slow general turnovers of your fly line through termination to your fly. You need a rod that can absorb the fight of a big fish and sometimes in fairly fast water. So objectively, what you want to look for, ideally, is a rod that's got more of a softer tip section and more of what we define as a more mid-flex action in the midsection. In other words, a fast action rod ideally suited to casting big streamers is not ideally the kind of rod that you use to essentially fish micro-small flies under those situations. So far as fly lines are concerned, well, I do have a preference for double taper lines and or lines that have got extended bellies. In other words, long belly profiles. And the reason being is that, as I already previously stated, you want a really good slow general turnover and a very soft touchdown of that fly line on the surface. In other words, you want to eliminate any direct surface activity from line splash or what we call shock waves that usually take place when a line hits the water hard, and it creates those issues, and that will often bring awareness to the fish, and you won't catch them. So no-no to me, as far as that is concerned, is the use of a weight-forward line, because that's exactly what you don't want it to do. Secondly, a long, or shall we say a double taper line, or a line of a weight-forward profile, a weight-forward long belly style profile, has a much thinner tip section. And that in itself also allows a little bit more delicacy insofar as controls of mends and drifts without, again, causing adverse surface disturbance on that water surface. But the absolute number one primary factor for a dry line is that it floats on the surface, not in it or below it, on it. So that when you mend line, you essentially are moving that line off the surface of the water and not up and or through it, which will create adverse issues in drag. Because as soon as you start to move the line, you will drag it. You're dragging it through the water. And guess what that does? That ultimately results in you doing the same thing to your fly. You'll drag it, you'll cause some disturbance, which is adverse to likelihood of that fish taking your fly. So far as leaders are concerned, well, I have my own personal ways of doing that. And to be honest about it, I prefer to build my own leader systems for a number of different reasons. One is, you know, there are different situations and circumstances that demand that you do that. You know, at certain situations, you may need a leader system that may be only 7 or 8 feet long in close quarter fishing. On the other hand, I may need leader systems that are anywhere from 15, 16, 17, and in extreme cases, maybe 18 feet in length. My primary concern is that that leader and or termination to the tip thereafter to the fly will land in a 100% direct straight line. And in many cases, factory manufactured leaders don't enable you to do that because it is very, very difficult to actually get that leader to straighten out. In other words, they have an inherent kind of twist in them. And personally, I dislike that, and it's not what I want. I want much more of a direct, if you like to put it, inline contact to the fly, without the effects of adverse drag, of course, as far as the drift of the fly is concerned. So all those things to me are paramount of importance. You know, the fly, for intensive purposes, is obviously what you want the fish to take, but before that, you've got to get everything right to enable the fish to have an interest to take that fly. And that is where a lot of guys go real wrong. They just don't get their setup, their preparation, their leader, their tippet termination correct, and they wonder why the fish don't take the fly. And the reason is because they're causing adverse issues on the surface of the water. You know, drag is an issue by far as far as fishing micro small flies are concerned. You might not be able to see it, but you can be sure that fish can see it. And right, more so if they're pressurized.
What do you do to make your line float on the surface and not in the surface?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of products out there on the market, but the one I've used all my life, in fact some 50 years, is an old British product by the name of Mucilin. It's not necessarily a product for you for dry flies or whatever the case may be, but its purpose to make a fly line float up on the surface, perfect. You know, to me, that is absolutely a number one priority, that your line floats on the surface. And you may have to, in the period of time when you're fishing, you know, have to re-grease that line up now and again to make sure that it does that. The advantage of Mucilin, incidentally, above a lot of the more liquid floating agents, is that as soon as it hits cold water, it solidifies. Whereas a lot of others, being more liquid, they tend to dissipate fairly quickly once they're, you know, subjected to the water on the fly line. So that's my number one choice, so far as maintaining high flow of my fly line, in any situation, incidentally, not just niche fishing.
Right, right. Yeah, so that sounds like it's important whenever you're using floating line. Like you say, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It's of utmost importance. I think that's a great tip. I think a lot of people don't take that precaution. You say that the Mucilin then evidently lasts longer before you have to reapply the characteristics that you just described.
Right? Yes, all I do with that is it comes in a little plastic container. You've got like a little felt wad in there, and essentially you just draw your fly line through it. The only one thing I will say over and above that is that anything that you use as an addition to help your fly line float will also to some extent attract to it crap in the surface of the water. So, you know, you just better make sure that now and again you give your fly line a good clean. And in fact, Roger, in that DVD, I made a point of demonstrating the difference between a fly line that was somewhat subsurface in the meniscus and one that was floating on the surface. And the viewers would clearly see how easy it is to manipulate line ends without surface disturbance, and more to the point, lift that line off the surface of the water with little or no disturbance without it running through and pushing wash as it is lifted up through that surface. All those adverse things are disadvantageous factors so far as making fish aware of the fact that you are there. You might not think it does, but it really it does.
Yeah, that demonstration you did, what was really amazing is, you know, so often, and I hadn't really thought about this much until I did watch your DVD, but, you know, we think throw a floating line out there on the water, and, yeah, it's floating. It might be floating an inch underneath the water, but
yeah,
it's floating, right? You know? It's
yeah, like, well, you assume that because you can visually see it. That's
right.
The thing. And even if it was 2 inches below the surface, you would still see it. But it doesn't mean to say it's floating on the surface. If you know what I mean by that, then that is what I consider to be very, very important.
Yeah, that surface tension, you're trying to relieve as much surface tension as possible so that line comes off really cleanly. Yeah.
Yes.
And I guess everybody could probably say that they might have looked downriver at the other guy and watched him lift his line off the water and see this spray of water backlit by the sun, right?
Yes. I tell people to do that when I'm teaching them. I say, hey, just go look downstream and as far as you are away, look what you can see. The guy is within 10 or 20 foot of a fish. What do you think it's seeing? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent tip and something that I will remember and use next time I'm on the water. There were some questions, one from Dick in Walla Walla, Washington, asking about furl leaders. And do you use those? What do you think of those leaders?
Personally, I do not. I mean, you guys out there that choose to use them, that's okay with me. Personally, I don't. I mean, furl leaders really historically go back, as you probably realized, many years ago when they built leader systems in that manner. I have my own ways of doing things. I like to do it in a very uncomplicated way. In other words, I kind of simplify what I do because it makes life a lot easier. And I build my leader systems up from amnesia, clear amnesia, not the red or the green, the fluorescent, clear amnesia. And essentially what I do is I just drop down in taper from the fly line in increments of amnesia, and then to that I add my extended leader and or tippet sections to the end of that. And one of the reasons why I use amnesia, the listeners want to know, is that amnesia is essentially an oval filament. It's not round, it's oval. An oval filament will tend to always straighten out on you. It tends not to have the inherent coils that round manufactured leader systems have. And again, as I said a little earlier on, that's so important to me that when I throw and deliver that line and that leader, that tippet to that fly on the surface of water, I want absolute, at times, pinpoint accuracy. In many cases, there's no margin for error. If that fish is looking at a food source that is within maybe a 4-inch diameter or circle, whatever, you've got to get that fly there. And you've got to get it there as many times as you can. Because in the case of niche fishing, not every time that your fly passes over that fish will it see it. Because it may not necessarily be actually looking there at that time. It may have risen, taken a food source from the surface, dropped down again, ready to come up to take the next one. So there's an intermittent period of time when the fish is either likely to see what you're putting across its head or not. And that applies with naturals too. If you watch feeding behaviors of fish, they don't take every fly that comes within their possible vision because they have movements that don't allow them to see them at certain times. And so you may need to make 10 casts to this one fish before you catch it. And the odds are, if you did everything right, the reason why you caught it is because it was at the time when it saw your fly. The other times, it may well have not. And oftentimes, you know, if you're in a position to actually look down on fish, bear in mind most times when we're fishing, we can't do that. We're actually looking across the screen to those fish. You cannot be 100% positive that you have got your fly accurately placed in the direct line that fish is looking for it. Unless maybe you are fishing directly from behind that trout and or you're presenting your fly more so in a downstream position where you can obviously see the fly moving down or whatever indication you've got where it is in the perfect line that the fish is looking into. So So that's important also.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that, definitely. We need to take a quick break, Davey. I'll come right back, and we'll dive right back into Mitch's presentation.
Okay.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Davey Wanton about Midge's presentation. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Davey, before we dive back in, you know, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. So what have you been up to? You been going to any shows, doing any more DVDs, writing any books? What have you been up to?
Yeah, absolutely. Last week I presented two programs in the state of Oklahoma, and we had great attendance. And in fact, Friday I leave and I'll be doing a program for the Kentuckian Fly Show this Saturday. Anybody in the area might want to go to it, because I believe, talking to the organizer earlier on today, that they've got a great attendance of persons there with all different items of fishing tackle for sale and this, that, and the other. And, of course, I'll be there doing some programs and presentations also. And then the next one after that will be for the Badger Fly Fishers Club in Wisconsin. So, yeah, this time of year, it's kind of, I don't know, we've had a pretty bad winter down here one way or the other, and that somewhat curtailed a lot of decent fishing days out there on the river, to be honest. But that's how it goes. And then we're probably going to do this year also a advanced Wet Fly Ways DVD. The Wet Fly Ways original DVD has been amazingly successful, and I know for definite that it's certainly created a lot of interest, more so in the art and skills of fishing traditional wet fly techniques. And there's a lot more I can add to what I did with my original DVD, and so that is what we've got in mind to do for this year.
Great, great. And what is your website? You want to give people your website address?
It's my name. It's Davey Wotton, DavyWotton .com.
Okay, easy enough. And people want any of the DVDs, flyfishtv.com is where they can find all the DVDs as well. So, good. Sounds like you got a busy winter coming up, and it's a shame you got to go north, though. It's not too pleasant up there right now, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I used to live in the north at one time before I moved to Arkansas, and winters were no fun. Personally, I dislike intense cold weather, because you can't do nothing much in it. You know what I mean? But, you know,
well, you can. It's good for drinking scotch inside by the fire.
I got enough of that to last me a year. That I can tell you. Or probably more.
Yeah. Good. Good. Well, good to hear what you're up to and that you're going to be at the shows where people can meet you and learn even more from you. So, well, let's talk more about some of the terminal tackle and so forth, because we did have more questions. Walt Cole in Redding, California asked, do you use a small swivel in your leader tippet connection to help it sink and keep the leader tippet from twisting? I know a lot of people are using swivels, but...
No, I don't. There are reasons why tippet twists, and that could be related to many different things. It could be related to casting issues. It could be related to wind direction related to the relative angle that you cast, and it could be the nature of the fly that you're using that creates that. So, I don't use anything like that at all.
Okay.
Because I think anything like that can also, ironically, create more issues than beneficial factors, to be perfectly honest about it. And I have no use mantra either for tippet rings, to be honest with you. There may be some nymphing situations I might use them, but that may be more related more so to the European style of techniques, but certainly not so far as midge fishing techniques are concerned.
Okay, yeah. I would think that would just be more things that take you away from that delicate presentation that you seek. Now, we had a couple questions on knots. Walt in Redding, California asked, you always use a non-slip loop knot. And then there was a question about the Davy knot, and then that was from Chuck in Santa Rosa, and Mark in Oregon also asked about loop knot. So you want to talk about clinch versus loop and describe the Davy knot and where they can learn how to tie it?
Yeah, sure. First and foremost, I don't use any other knot other than to tie a fly on other than my knot, the Davy knot. And there are reasons why. First one is, I've used that knot since the 50s. It was the only way I could figure out when I was a kid to tie a fly on. But more importantly, is a micro-small knot. And that's very, very important. When you're tying on very, very small flies, 18s, 20s, 22s, 24s, 26s, the last thing you need is a large knot that's obtrusive to the size of the fly you're fishing. Because, for many reasons. One is, you know, it can attract light and it gives away the visual effect of the fly or detracts from it. I also know that in certain situations, it more likely will wary the fish up and spook them. Whereas if you've never practiced to tie that Davy knot, I would suggest that you try it. And it's very easy to figure it out. All you've got to do is just go and Google it, Davy fly knot, and you'll find it with instructions how to do it. You can tie that knot in less a few seconds. It's unbelievably fast. But most people, when they see it, they think, you can't be serious, you know? Well, I can assure you that if you tie that knot correctly, there's absolutely no reason why that knot will fail on you. Unless you did something to cause it to happen, or you didn't tie it correctly, or, you know, you just didn't deal with the hook fish. I've seen so many big trout in my time caught with that knot. So, you know, I have 150% confidence that the knot is not the issue. Any knot can be an issue. Make no mistake about that. For lots of different reasons, you know. It could be that the filament you're using is maybe subpar or something like that. You didn't tie it right. You set the hook on the fish a little too hard. There's so many different reasons as to why a knot will fail. The primary factor is whatever it is you use, you have confidence in. That, to me, that's the most important thing. And obviously, where I am concerned, that knot I have 150% confidence in because I've used it all my life and I've seen literally hundreds of thousands of trout caught with that knot used to attach the fly to.
Now, with that said, is the Davy knot a non-slip loop knot, or is it a clinching knot?
No, essentially, it's a tight knot to the eye of the hook.
Okay.
You know, a slip loop knot, which other people would define as more as a Duncan loop or something like that, I'm not saying that doesn't have some uses, but if I was going to use that knot, I would use it generally more for larger flies, you know, larger, like hoppers and stuff like that, or possibly streamers or whatever.
Right.
Insofar as midges concerned, I would have to be convinced, which I'm not, that it makes any difference whatsoever to use that knot on a micro-small fly, which, of course, also relates to the fact that you're using a piece of metal, a hook, that's got virtually zero weight. You know, and I don't believe that in the case of that style of fishing, any animation, if there is any at all, is significant. But because of the size of the fly and the fact that you're almost always fishing it dead drift, so how can it be? You know, it's not like if I was fishing a hopper on the surface, you know, where you're subjected to, generally speaking, faster water, disturbance on the water surface that agitates and moves the fly around, or of course, in the techniques I deploy with wet fly fishing or soft tackles, which are, that's a slightly different scenario. Midge fishing generally demands a almost perfect dead drift scenario with no adverse surface disturbance caused by you to that fly.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Now, do you ever use fluorocarbon? And if so, when?
Yes, frequently I do. You know, I was around fly fishing long before fluorocarbon ever came onto the market. And to be honest about it, fly fishermen today, or all of us, are somewhat blessed to some extent with, you know, modern technology. Doesn't matter what it is, whether it's in fly rods, whether it's in fly lines, whether it's in monofilament material, fluorocarbon, or whatever. Years ago, you did not have those choices. And so the consequence of that is you learn to use what you had at that particular time. Now, if you were to ask me the question, do I think it makes any significant difference? It would be hard to argue that one way or the other. But I would have to say, in all probability, it does, if that was my honest opinion about that. But fluorocarbon most definitely has significant uses. I think the most important thing, more than anything else, regardless of whether you use, you know, monofilament, copolymer, fluorocarbon, or whatever else, is the aspect of visibility to that material that you have got your fly attached to. Because that could make a big difference. If it's too visible to the fish, the odds are it may not take your fly. Because when they're taking small microorganisms, doesn't matter whether waterborne or terrestrial, you have to bear in mind that the fish's point of vision to that small organism is extremely acute. I don't know what a fish sees. I can't tell you that. But what I do know, if it's capable of seeing a little tiny micro small fly, it's sure enough capable of seeing the filament that you've got it attached to. And whether or not that filament detracts from the fish taking your fly is another matter, which I know for a fact in many cases it is. And so all I will say about that is that you should always bear in mind that the filament that you attach your fly to should be considered so far as its visibility to the fish, good, bad, or indifferent. And I also know of situations where I've changed filaments and had more positive results over and above the one I was previously using because, A, the color of that filament, the prevailing light conditions, background color of the water or reflection off the bed of the river because it was gravel or whatever, made a difference to the visibility of that filament in the water to the fish, whether it be on the surface, in the meniscus, or below it. So all I would say to the listeners is just stay, be very mindful about the filament that you choose to use and in whether or not it has a higher level of awareness to the fish over and above your fly, which is what you want the fish to take in the first place. Okay?
Okay.
So fluorocarbon to me definitely has advantages, but probably not as much as people think it does, but it certainly does. Let's put it that way.
It might be that 0.5% that gets a fish at times, huh? And sometimes I think that's what it takes, too, right? I mean, it's just that one little tweak that will make it or break.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, you can have five guys all fishing exactly the same rig system, exactly the same, flies, everything. But one of those guys is persistently catching fish while the others are not. Now, he's obviously doing something different. And I guarantee you what he's doing different, bearing in mind everybody else is set up in the same way, is the value of his presentation. I almost guarantee that is the reason why he is getting the success and the others are not.
Yeah.
Because there's no other reasoning why, if you follow my meaning.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that sixth sense they always talk about on when to set the hook. Some people have a better sense of that than others. Or maybe it's just...
Doubt.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. I think, you know, in a lot of... You know, I always try to tell anglers this, you know, there's only three ways you can catch a fish. Okay, the first one is you actually feel it take your fly. In other words, when you're skipping and screaming, bang, you feel it, okay? The second one is visual. By visual, I mean that either you're sight fishing, you visually see that fish take your fly, and or you have some other visual means that it did so, regardless whether you're using a sight indicator, whether you're watching the leader, whether you see a disturbance in the surface of the water, that's visual. The other one is sixth sense. You just know, fish caught my fly, you raise the rod, and there's one hooked on the end, and the guy next to you says, how did you catch that fish? Well, you know, you don't tell him that, do you? You say, yeah, well, didn't you see the line move? But I think that you have to develop what I would define more as more of an acute sense of focus and attention to minute detail, particularly when you're fishing with small micro flies. You know, as good as my eyesight is, I can't necessarily always see my fly, particularly when I'm fishing very small emergers and dries. But I know where it is. And the reason I know where it is because from the time that that fly landed on the surface, I never take my eyes from where I know the direction of that fly is. And bear in mind what I said earlier on in the program, I know where it is because I can always throw a direct, straight line, accurate cast. And so I know where that fly initially landed on the surface. If you are unable to do that, if you throw a cast which is somewhat all over the place and lands down in a heap in the water and a pile up, that's worthless, absolutely worthless. You have to develop the skill where you can throw everything in a direct, straight, accurate line, and from that point onwards know exactly where your fly is and never take your eye away from it. You know, you probably have the experience that most others have. When they're fishing with small indicators or indicators in water that's somewhat disturbed or the sunlight hitting it, they turn their head away, and then when they go looking back for their indicator, they can't find it because they took their eyes away from it in the first place. You have to maintain a higher level of focus and concentration to the furthest visible point that you can see to know that the fish has taken your fly. And it may not be caused by the fact that the fish tugs and jerks away, but because often it's not. When midge fishing, they do not do that. They just come up and they just gently open their mouths and they just take that fly. They don't make exaggerated movements like they would maybe when they take caddis. You know, they move to the left, to the right, they make splashes and various other indications that took that natural fly. You have to have a high level of focus, concentrate to that small zone, you know, where your fly is. And we'll talk about that in a little bit, but there are other things that you can also do to give you that point of recognition to know that a fish did take your fly.
Yeah. Now, there were several questions. I'm going to try to lump them together here, all basically on tandem fly presentation. Joe in Houston, Texas, Rick Takahashi up in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Eddie Sherman, Connecticut, originally Scotland.
Yeah. Well, he's another Celt. There you go.
So they are all asking similar questions about, do you rig up in tandem? How do you do it? How many flies do you use? How far apart are they? So can you kind of describe what your setup there is?
Yeah, sure. Yes, I do. At times, use two flies, which may be combinations of two coronamid nymphs, little tiny midge pupas. They may be a combination of a pupa and or an emerger, a combination of, say, a pupa and a dry or an emerger and a dry. Yes, I do. My means and methods of using two flies is to always have one fly attached as a dropper. In other words, a detached dropper, usually about 4 to 5 inches in length. In the case of very, very small flies like that, I know some people do it that way, but it's not my choice. I don't use the practice of tying the dropper fly or the fly above the tail fly either by the bend or the eye. I've never fished that way myself ever. I've always believed in the fact that a detached fly has more natural animation in movement of water, but more to the point, it's easier for a fish to come up, take it, and get hooked. Because I've watched fish many times when I'm out in that boat on my river, which is a gin clear water, come up. What I'm trying to tell you is that, you know, I spent a lot of time studying stuff, that when you have a fly in line with the one below, often as not, the fish's face will hit the line before it can get the fly. And also for it to engulf that fly, you would have to turn somewhat more so on its side to take it, which generally is not natural where a trout's concerned. They generally like to take something directly coming toward them, open their mouth and close down on it. Whereas with a detached dropper, because that detached dropper is always at the mercy of movement in the water, it can move around and it gives the fish a little better option to come and take that fly at any angle, above, below, left, right, center, or whatever the case may be. And I have no problem in tying detached droppers with fine tippet material either. At 6X, it's not an issue to me. I noticed there's a question on that. It relates to diameter of line, and at the same time, I'll answer that one right now. What do I choose as diameter of line to fish flies? Well, let me tell you, the simple answer is this. As small as I can go, particularly in the case of fishing small flies, I don't have an issue of concern regarding fishing, you know, 6 or 7X line. Because my experience tells me how to deal with fish when I've got them hooked on light line like that. However, there are situations where you may be kind of pushing your limits, particularly in situations where you've got adverse effects of force of water, that, okay, you know, I'm going to hook this fish very light in this slower pool, but all of a sudden when I've hooked him, he's going to take off downstream in this fast rushing water. What are my chances of dealing with that fish in when I'm hooked up to him with, you know, maybe 6 or 7X? Maybe good, maybe not. You know, we're all going to lose fishing fine tippet, no matter who you are. And the other issue, too, when you're fishing small flies, is that you never know when you've got a real good hook hold. Often, as we know, small hooks only generally catch very small amounts of skin on the outside of the fish's mouth. Don't take too much to pull that little fly out. I mean, I know the guys, and I myself also, when we fish on the San Juan, if you look at those fish, you know, the erosion around their mouth parts is pretty significant, largely because of the fact that they've been hooked on very small flies, and over time, the process of being hooked and broken off or pulling out has eroded the skin parts around that fish's mouth. But anyway, the question is that what diameter pipet I use as fine as I can get away with. And most times when I'm fishing midges, it's usually going to be 6/8, if not 7/8.
Okay. Steve Bourne, who's also been on our show, has sent a question, and he's asking about where you put the weight when you're fishing a tandem setup. You know, do you put it above the two flies, in between them? Do you weight it below the point fly? How do you apply your weight?
Oh,
what do you use for weight, too?
Well, you know, that question is really very much based on the fact of the situation of circumstances at the time where you're fishing and what it is you need to do as far as presentation values are concerned. So the answer to this question would be simply this. Sometimes I may have those flies spaced apart as much as 2 feet, rarely less than 15 inches, probably more like 20 inches to be perfectly honest about it. So I may have weight added in between those two flies. I may have weight above those flies. It really goes down to what it is you need to do as far as your presentation value is concerned. And I don't think there's an absolute answer I could give him to say, look, under this situation, you do this, because I would have to see exactly the situation to make my decision about how I would choose to do that. But I will say this. You will be surprised, even if you're fishing a very small fly, you know, 18s, 20, 22s, how deep that little fly will sink without any addition of weight, more so than most people realize. There are situations of circumstances that would, you know, somewhat eliminate that. For example, certain times of the year when you get a lot of surface tension on the water, usually when the water surface is warm, that is the case, that there's just not enough weight to pull that leader, excuse me, your tippet system through that meniscus and get your fly down. Well, in a situation like that, yes, you might need to add some weight. And there are a couple of ways you can do that. I use, most of the time, little micro shots. But what I mean by micro is very, very small, size 8 and size 10. They're micro, micro, small. The downside is, for every one you can get on the line, you probably dropped 10 before you did it. And then you've also, you follow, and if you've got cold hands, it's nearly impossible, I can tell you. And then you've got some malleable substances that you can buy. And then, of course, you just roll it up in a little ball or make a what we call a mouse dropping shape with it. And you just roll that around your tip of material. And that helps us too. But, you know, most definitely the thing that's dramatically changed fly fishing to a large extent here in the United States is the introduction of beadheads to flies. And no argument about that whatsoever. I guarantee you that probably 80%, if not more, of the guys at Nymphfish will have a box full of probably 75% flies which have got beadheads on them. Now, that said, beadheads can be a whole different thing. You know, you can have tungsten, you can have very lightweight beadheads, and also you can use, of course, as we know, like glass. So all of those have got some practical use because they're different colors, they're different sizes, that they do. So, you know, if you wanted to add a small amount of weight, for example, to a tied fly, then you could go with one of those little tiny micro glass beads. Perfect, you know, because they have some illusions of light effect to your fly, whatever color it is you use. So there's lots of different things that you can use for the same fly. So if you tied, for example, a black zebra midge, you could put a silver bead on it, a copper bead, a nickel bead, a gold bead, or one of the many, many different colors of glass beads. All give you different options as far as, A, illusion to the fly from the fish's perspective, but also the change and or addition of weight that you can incorporate in that fly to suit certain prevailing fishing situations that you may come up against. And ironically, while we're on that subject, as far as weight addition is concerned, that also is probably absolutely one of the most important aspects as far as midge fishing is concerned, where subsurface flies are concerned. That's excluding emergers and dries, of course. That the depth that often you fish your fly at has to be absolutely critical. What I mean by critical, if it's, you know, above and or below the point of vision where the fish is looking for naturals, the chances are you're not going to catch it because it's not looking for your fly in the right place in the first place. So weight is very important, and it can make a real big difference. Believe me, it really, really can. And it's not easy always for us humans to determine the exact depth the fish is at, because it's very difficult when you're looking across to them and or down on top of them to know exactly the depth that fish is at. If you are familiar with that piece of water, for example, I could say, pick a section up here in my own river at Bull Shoals Dam. I know that if I walked out to that section of water, that the depth is 17 inches. And if I moved over to that position, it was 19 inches. So at least I know in my mind, without having to go out there in the first place, what depths of water I'm dealing with. And it also gives me a good perspective to know exactly where to set the depth of my fly in relation to where I'm likely to see that fish take that fly. So if I don't see fish generally feeding on or near the surface or coming up to have an interest to take something on or near the surface, odds are I know I have to fish that fly somewhere close to the bed of the river. Not on it, but close to it, within, say, 6 inches of the bed of that river. I know that if that fly is coming toward that trout, left side or right side of its eyes or in front of it, there is odds are he will see it and he will take it. So bait addition is a very important issue so far as values of presentation, no doubt about it.
Right, right. Now, that's when you think about fish in the water column, because this is I know this is a challenge for every one of us out there is trying to determine where they are. But if you were to look through the water column and say, you know, where fish are most of the time, in other words, you could say that, you know, if they're feeding on emergers or, you know, duns or something on the surface, then they're going to be within the top foot of the water. If there's no surface activity, then where are they normally? Are they within a foot of the bottom, would you say, as opposed to anywhere in the middle of the column, just because of the water speed and so forth at the bottom?
Yeah, that's a good question, and there's no accurate answer I can give you to that, other than this. Is that, first and foremost, if you can visually see the fish, and I assume that's what you're saying, right? Okay? If you can visually see that fish, that'll give you a notice of whether or not that fish is actively feeding. Because if it is, and you can see it, you should be able to see that it is doing that. So, if you see that fish making slight movements to the left or right, and you see it opening its mouth, then it's telling you there's obviously some natural food source in there that fish is feeding on at that particular point of time. If, however, you just see that fish in a lie, what we define as a set position, and essentially just really doing nothing other than just finning its tail to maintain its position, well, it's telling you a couple of different things, obviously. But the primary thing it's telling you is that there doesn't appear to be anything there in the water column that's given any interest for that fish to feed. That's not to say that if you present a fly to it, it won't take it, because odds are it may well do so. So the answer to that question is this. I can't tell you, and I don't know anybody else that can, exactly by looking into the water at what depth that fish is at. If it's real close to the bottom, you may have some better visual to that, because you won't be able to see anything below the fish. In other words, you'll see its belly looking real tight to the bed of the river. But your relative angle, insofar as your vision to where you see that fish, will change that. So, you know, if you're too close to him, that's one thing, but if you're standing further back, you're going to see a different relative angle to the position of that fish in that water. And again, all I will say is that, to some extent, by try and error, if you present your fly in a manner without disturbing that fish, and you see no interest from the fish initially, it may well be that it's not seeing your fly. So do something different. If it needs the requirement of a little added weight to get the fly down lower, then do it. Sooner or later, you're going to get some knowledge that the fish is seeing that fly. He's either going to move away from it because you spooked him, or he's going to have some interest maybe to take it. Sooner or later, you will get, if you visually can sight fish to that fish, some indication that it's seen your fly, whether it's good or it's bad. Okay?
Okay. Sounds good. Let me take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the more informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Davey Wanton about midge presentations. And if you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, Davey, I did get a bunch of questions on the Internet. I'm going to try to knock some of these off, even if they're not on topic here, so we can acknowledge these folks. Well, Phil Murray sent in a couple of them. One question kind of related to what you were just talking about, which was, you know, working a trout all different ways and trying to get them hooked up. And Phil was saying, when do you give up on a picky trout?
That's it. You know what? That's a really good question. It largely depends on your degree of persistence, to be honest about it. Obviously, there comes a time when the fish has become aware of the fact of your presence, whether it's because it sees you, sees what you're doing. It's become so aware that the probability is you can fish all week in the same manner to the same fish and not catch it. So what I will answer that question by simply is this. If you believe in your mind that you have presented your flies in a right, proper, correct manner and had zero interest from that fish, okay, then leave it. Go away and leave it. In other words, rest it. And then come back maybe half an hour or three quarters of an hour and approach it in a different way, not by the manner in which you previously did and didn't catch it. It's very difficult to determine yourself to some extent, unless it's an obvious one, that you have heightened the awareness of that fish. An obvious one is that you run it off. It takes off. Or
right.
You did something that momentarily frightened it, for example. You assume that you've got the fish to take the fly, and you go to set the hook, and just that sudden movement of that fly dragging past it or your indicator spooked it. It might not take off, but you certainly got it alarmed. And so the odds are once that fish is somewhat sense the fact that something ain't right out there, if you persist in doing what you're doing, you're probably not going to catch it because its sense of awareness is somewhat more heightened. And so my answer to that is it's not so much a question of giving up on a fish. It's more a question of consideration to the fact that, hey, I've got that fish wised up. I may as well just leave him alone and come back, you know, a half an hour. And I will tell you, oftentimes when you do that, the odds are, often than not, you'll catch that fish within the first three or four presentations.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you're doing something different, too. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Now, I have a saying, and it's this. It's called the heron stance. And what I mean by that is this, is that a heron is a bird that has the ability to stand absolutely still without any movement. And by virtue of the fact that it is capable of doing so, fish essentially will come so close that heron can just jerk down and catch them. You and I, when we fish, cannot do that. We move around. Our body moves, our fly rod moves, our fly line moves. We do lots of different things that can cause visual, shall we say, awareness to that fish that you are there. The heron doesn't do that, and that's the difference. And that's another thing I try to emphasize in that DVD on midge fishing. Your initial approach, before you ever cast a fly to that water, is so important. If you go wading and crashing out in that water, you create shock waves that go across stream, upstream, downstream, and do all sorts of different things in situations where, you know, fish are in fairly slow, calm water. I guarantee you, you have created an awareness to those trout that you are there. From that point onwards, you may suffer the consequences, because from that point onwards, bear in mind, you weren't the only angler that those fish have seen in their life. Or the odds of it are extremely remote, that being the case. Therefore, you've wised them up, and it may well be you cast away, and nothing happens. Why? Because your initial approach was wrong to start with. And it's something that very few anglers really pay attention to. You know, is the sun behind me casting a shadow right across the river to where those fish are? And generally, bear in mind, when we're midge fishing, we're not fishing at extreme ranges. Most midge fishing is what we define more as close quarter fishing, which requires stealthy approach, non-awareness to the fish of your presence, values whereby you present the fly in a manner where they don't know anything else other than what's going on around them other than ideally they see your fly first before anything else. And the more you can lock into your mind, that is your means and or approach, I guarantee you, the more fish you will ultimately catch. I mean, you will.
Definitely. Okay, some more questions here from the internet.
Yes.
Phil in California, Kentucky says, I heard that big fish like big flies, in your experience, to big trout ignore a well-fished streamer and take midges instead.
Repeat that question.
Yeah, he says, he's heard that big fish like big flies, but we know that they like small flies too.
Oh, yeah.
He says, in your experience, do big trout ignore a well-fished streamer and go after midges instead? So if we've got a midge hatch on, will they ignore a streamer and stick with the small flies? I guess is what he's saying.
Oh, okay. Let me just put it in this manner. If I have approached a section of water and I can actively see fish, no matter what size they are, I mean, bear in mind the average trout that the majority of us catch in the United States period is about a 10 or 12 inch fish. You know, the White River is an exception to the rule because of so many big brown trout it holds, over 20 inches. But that's beside the point. The fact of the matter is that if I actively see fish feeding on small microorganisms, then my logical approach is to fish those flies for those fish, for lots of reasons, because that's the way I want to catch them to start with. If, however, I decided to chuck out a big fat streamer in water like that, I'm not saying I might not catch a fish, but I would say more to the point the odds of me spooking them and running them off are greater because of the manner in which you're fishing such a fly in those kind of water situations.
Right.
In other words, bear in mind that when you're fishing midge water situations, it's generally slower moving water. It's usually more of a flat surface on the water. If there's a lot of surface disturbance on water caused by upstream wind or crossstream wind or downstream winds, it's very, very difficult for fish to see small microorganisms in the wave trough. That's not to say you can't catch them on midge imitations more in a nymphal form, fish below that wave trough, because the odds of you being able to do so are pretty damn good. But that may be a situation there, you know, that yeah, you could get away if you're wave fishing some streamers. But my logical approach is to fish what my eyes and the fish are telling me is the most logical way to go about fishing for those fish. And like I said, if I see them eating small microorganisms, midges, then that's what my approach is largely going to be. But you never know what a fish will do. There ain't no such thing as never in the world in fly fishing. Because there isn't. Because
yep.
I have so many situations in my life, it's like, that's unbelievable. But it happened. But
yeah.
You know what? Yeah, it ain't going to happen every day. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Ken Prager in Pennsylvania wants to know if you're going to be at the Somerset, New Jersey show this weekend.
No, I'm not, because I'm going to be at the Kentuckian Fly Show here in Louisville, Kentucky this Saturday.
Okay, that answers that.
But tell him my good friends Dave and Emily Whitlock will be there.
Oh, Dave and Emily, yeah, Whitlock, yeah. Lanford in Castle Rock, Colorado, he says he'd like to know where he can get the DVDs. And Lanford, you can get those at flyfishtv.com, flyfishtv.com. So you get all of Davey's stuff there.
Yeah, and you can go directly to my website, email me also, that's no problem.
Yep, okay, DaveyWanton.com.
Yes, sir.
So, either place, and here's another one, Mark Scheel in Albuquerque. He said, when utilizing midge hatches, 20 to 24 hook sizes, is sight fishing techniques recommended, or is it a clear dead drift? I think those kind of go together, don't they? Don't you want to have a clear dead drift?
I think what he's asking me, if I'm right here, is that do I determine fishing small flies based on the fact that I can only see fish feeding in the surface or not? Well, the answer is it doesn't make any difference. I mean, he's not that too far away there from the San Juan River, which I'm sure he goes to fish in Albuquerque. But on that river, that'll teach you that experience. They may not necessarily be seeing female near the surface, but I can bet you money that if you fish small flies subsurface, you'll catch those fish. If your presentation values are right. So, again, I have to go back to the scenario that if that particular water system you fish is known to have a lot of small microorganisms, in that we're particularly coronomies, then you know that it's normal practice for those fish to feed on those coronomies. Therefore, it's good practice to fish artificials to represent those. Whereas on another river, that might not necessarily be the case. Saying that, there are very few rivers that don't have small midge hatches. It doesn't matter, like I said, you know, whether they're mayfly, whether they're coronomids or whatever else. And for another thing too is, you know, I get asked a lot of questions by guys on the river, you know, they come up to you and they say, well, what are you using to catch those fish with? Well, the obvious answer is, well, I sell a fly. Yeah, I know that, but what fly? And I says, first and foremost, I says, you ask the question because you believe that the answer to your success is the fly. And I will tell them, I said, the odds are the reason why you're not getting any success is what you're doing, is your approach and your presentation values. That they are the issues as far as you're concerned. Well, how do you know that? And I says, well, because I was watching you. You were 50 yards down the river and I could see what you were doing. Oh. So, it's a wrong assumption to assume that, you know, by and large, the fly is the magic answer to catching fish. It is part of the equation. But by far, as I said earlier on in the program, your initial approach, how you build your system, your presentation values, your controllers, your drifts, are far more important than fly that you've got on the end. Because if you do everything else wrong, what makes you think it's going to take your fly at the end? Now and again, you might get one take it by accident. But fishing by design and by accident are two different issues.
Right. We got a bunch of questions here from on flies, so I'm going to try to run through these because I know we're running out of time here. Paul in Idaho asks about, he says, normally we can't see midges in mountain streams. They're so tiny. How do we decide what sizes and colors to use?
You know, that's another good question, too. My philosophy has always been this in all my life of fly fishing. And as you know, I fished over 40 different countries in the world in every kind of freshwater system you can imagine for trout. And no matter whether little tiny creeks, brooks, streams, massive great reservoirs, man-made, whatever. And my philosophy has always been this, is that I know that any body of water contains a multitude of different organisms that fish will feed on, from micro-small organisms such as Daphnia to as big as you want, dragonflies being the largest because they're the largest waterborne insect anyway, period. So there's always some train of thought so far as presentation or use of certain flies that will attract a fish to eat them, because being what they are by nature, they're always looking for a food source. And as we all know, they will take or engulf items which they believe to be edible, but they're not, and they spit them back out again. The difference is when we present a fly that they take in their mouths like that, we react by setting a hook because we got an indication to the fact that they did that before they've had time to eject it, which otherwise they would. So to answer his question, I don't know that particular body of water that he's fishing. I don't know what fly life exists in that body of water, but I'd be almost sure that there are small microorganisms in that body of water. And there's absolutely no reason why, if he fished very small flies, 18s or 20s, he could not catch those fish. I will agree that there are differences in so far as chemistry in water is concerned. You know, water that's more acidic as opposed to alkaline will generally have a lesser amount of aquatic fly life in it than one that's more alkaline. But generally speaking, my experience has also told me that on waters where they're a little more acidic and there's less natural food sources in the water, the fish are a little more aggressive. In other words, they look a little more eager towards anything they believe to be a food source because they don't see it that often. They're more possibly reliant on terrestrials than anything else. Whereas, of course, in a water that's more alkaline, there is a massive amount of natural food sources. It doesn't matter whether they're scubs, whether they're sour bugs, whether they're species of mayflies or caddis or midges or stoneflies, whatever. So there's more awareness of the fish in those rivers about all the different aquatic forms of life that exist. And that, to some extent, gives you a wider variance of use of different kinds of flies to attract those fish, bearing in mind that there are certain times of the year where there is a predominance of a specific species which is more, shall we say, acceptable to the fish because that's what they essentially feed on at that time, be it stoneflies, caddis, or mayflies.
So one of the rules of thumb I always have is, especially if you're in an area that you don't know, is go to that local shop and talk to the guides and the shop owners and find out what works on that river. And that way you can eliminate a lot of guessing and know what has been successful, at least.
That might be true to some extent, but, the irony of that, generally speaking, is if 10 guys went in that store, one after the other, I guarantee you that they'll be told these are the fish you need. Well, it was always fascinated me that when you go to a fly shop, they have maybe 10 flies, maybe less, and they say, well, yeah, these are the go-to flies. Well, I always look at it from this perspective also. Everybody out there is chucking the same flies to those fish, and the odds are they've kind of got wised up to seeing them as well. And from my point of view, my experience differs, and, I don't follow that way of thinking, but I agree with what you're saying, that at least that's a starting point, if you go in there and the guy says, well, today they're hitting on this and that, the other, it gives you some idea whether you're fishing, whether the nymphs, dries, or emerges, or whatever,
Yeah. There was a couple of questions here. Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins want to know, talking about chironomids, what is the stage of chironomids' life cycle that you feel is most productive for feeding trout?
Oh, that's a good question, too. Almost certainly the stage that is probably more so of interest to us as fly fishermen is the stages of emergence, i.e. the pupal to the emerger, to the adult. And the reason being it is more of interest to us fly fishers is because that is what creates more surface interest from the fish, and we visually see those fish. And I think most fishermen would generally tell you that to them, the sight of fish surface feeding or visually being able to see them and catching them is a little more exhilarating and exciting as opposed to fishing flies on or near the bed of the river where they can't see the fish. And I would have to agree with that myself. There's nothing more satisfying than seeing a big fish, rise, taking naturals, midges, and you present your fly in a right and proper way and you hook up your 24-inch brown by doing that. I mean, nothing can beat that. That's not to say, I don't have satisfaction with catching big trout while I don't see them, because I do, but it's not quite the same thing. It's hard for me to really answer that one in some respect, but tell me again what you asked me. I just forgot.
Sure. You want to know what stage of the chironomid's life cycle is
productive. Okay. What I was going to add, it was this. The larva of chironomids, obviously, insofar as most tailwater systems, is very, very small. And, of course, we know those as bloodworms. And they can be in different colors, too. They can be brown, they can be red, they can be green, and I've seen in other colors. There are certain times, fishing imitations of those can be unbelievably productive, particularly when you see a situation of changing water. Here on my river system, of course, it's a tailwater, and it can be subject to intense generation levels, anything from 0 to 24,000 CFS. And that in itself, when you get fast water movement like that, tends to start to scarf off substrate off the riverbed. And the consequence of that is that it churns up the bloodworms or the larva of the chironomids, which are there at one point of time submerged in the gravel and the sand and the silt in that substrate. And that can be a very, very productive time to fish imitations of chironomid larva. That's not to say that they won't or cannot be effective at other times, because they can. The deal is you've got to be able to make them small enough. That's the thing. Now, a San Juan worm is not a representative of a chironomid larva. I mean, some people still believe that. I think it's a midge larva. Well, it's not, of course, as we all know, or most of us.
Yeah.
Midge larva are very, very small. They're very, very fine in diameter. And pretty much, about the closest you're going to get to kind of imitate those is use a micro small hook, maybe a 20-22, and essentially just tie on about a half-inch length or a smaller piece of red, brown, or olive floss on the shank of that hook, and that's it. That's good enough to imitate one of those.
Right, exactly. We did have some more questions about flies. Jesus in Spain want to know what patterns you recommend. Well, you just described many of the midge patterns, just tie them in different colors, but he was wondering about Griffith's gnat and so forth. I don't know if they have the same flies over there in Spain that we normally have, but and then there was questions about, colors and sizes of midges. What do you carry in your box? So maybe you can kind of talk about the flies in your box a little bit.
Yeah, I can. All right. If I was to pick one overall color that probably in most cases will likely catch you fish when they're taking piranhas, it would be black. Okay? Saying that, you should also have with you combinations that are in red, brown, tan, olive, in different sizes. Now, I'm talking about very simple, basic thread-bodied pupa patterns, with or without beaded. In other words, variables of zebra midges. But I also tell you, contrary to belief, it is not necessary always to rip those with wire. A simple thread-bodied midge, just thread, on that hook shank, and sometimes not even with a bead, just a micro-small amount of ball dubbing at the head of the fly, is more than enough to convince those fish to eat that fly. Sometimes we do things wrong. We put too much flash to a fly, and ribbing tinsel will tend to do that. So will the addition of little tags of tinsel in this, that, and the other. I'm not saying for one moment that at times they're not the flies to use, because they are, but there's also times when they will detract of the likelihood of the fish taking your fly. So, to answer the question, if you have with you a good cross-section of thread-bodied midges in sizes 18, 20, 22, and 24, in the primary colors of red, black, olive, tan, and brown, with and without additions of bead heads or glass heads, okay, then you need a selection of emergers. And an emerger, really, for a midge is nothing much more than the same thread-bodied midge with some addition to it. A hackle, one and a half turns of micro small hackle at the head. Maybe something that imitates to some extent the wings. That's all the emerger needs to be, just an addition over and above the thread body, okay? Then you have drives. And a Griffith net is a good one, no doubt about that. And there are others also. I'll tell you another interesting thing that I've always found in my life. Every water system has got some peculiarity to it. What I mean by that is this, is that there are certain flies for this particular water that generally prove always to be successful, but may not be so on another water, even though the food base the trout are feeding on is the same. I can't answer you that question why that is the case, because it is the case. And so if you fish a particular river system, you find, for example, that a red thread-bodied zebra-style midge is the killer, well, you know you've got confidence to use that fly in that particular water because it works. On the other hand, if you go to another river, then they pay no interest to it for one reason or the other. And you may find that black or olive are the flies to use on that river. You know, a lot of that really boils down to your experience and knowledge of the particular waters that you fish. So you build up that background knowledge of requirement for those particular waters. But saying that, if you have a good cross-section of the flies that I mentioned, then you generally should not go far wrong in any water system, at least fishing piranhas. But saying that, bear in mind, midges, in my definition, are not just related to piranhas. So you should have a small selection of general dries. And I will tell you, the absolute number one you generally can't go too far wrong with is a micro-small Adams in size 20-22. That is a first-class micro-small dry fly.
Yep.
Then you may have small imitations of Baitis, blue-winged olives, stuff of that nature. Canis, that's another one. You know, this. You have to consider that at times the organism that is favored by the fish has to be very closely replicated by your artificial, because they become, in our terminology, selective, which is another kind of weirdness in some respects. You know, guys will say to me, well, you know, I didn't catch none of those fish because they were selectively feeded. And I said, what you're basically telling me is that you have not figured out how to catch them. Your perspective was the fact that the fish were doing something, obviously, and paid no attention to what you were doing. That's why you couldn't catch them. Well, yeah, that's right. I says, well, the answer is you have not figured out how to catch them.
Yeah.
Because under the law of averages, if a trout is visually seen feeding, you should potentially be able to catch it, or at least hook it. You may lose it, but you deceive it. That's the deal right there. But I will also accept there are times that fish can become extremely difficult to catch. I mean, they can become extremely difficult to fish, catch. And my perspective and the reason why that is so is because they've been pressurized and fished for many, many times by us humans, and their senses of awareness are somewhat more heightened than the fish that has not. And therefore, your values of presentation have just got to be so much better to catch those fish. And I know a number of rivers in Colorado that are like that. Unless you do everything right, you will not deceive those fish. You've got to get everything right. And I have to say again, that all stems from, A, your initial approach, your means and methods of building up your system, your presentation values, more so than the fly, albeit that is an important issue. Everything else got to be right to start with.
Well, that's one thing I know every time I talk to you, Davey, it's I realize how important that fly fishing is a thinking person's game. And if you're not thinking, you're not catching fish. That problem solving you just described a few minutes ago is like, well, you know, and I get into that rut many times myself of just keep doing the same thing and expecting different results. And we know we've heard that time and time again, but that I see it on the river all the time. And,
oh, yes.
You know, the way that you talk about fly fishing, it's science, it's art, it's magic, all wrapped
yeah.
into one, but you got to be thinking, that's for sure. So.
There's one thing that, I guess we've got a few minutes yet, right?
Well, you got about a minute.
Okay. There's one thing we didn't get to talk about, and that was the use of indicators, okay?
Okay.
And very quickly, all I will say about this, A, there is nothing wrong in the use of an indicator, but I will emphasize this more than anything else. You must, if you use an indicator, use a micro, small indicator. I see guys here on my river, and I've seen them elsewhere. They're intending to catch fish. They're surface feeding or subsurface feeding on midges. They're using an indicator that you could suspend a 5-ounce chub on. How on earth do you expect to see a very, very, very delicate indication of the take that the fish has taken your fly? You will not. And the chances are the fact that you're fishing a big bubba and it hits the water with a whack will spook the fish before you even start. And my absolute first choice for indicator use, if needed, is to use micro small amounts of yarn. And you do that by using what we call a double loop, and you actually link that small amount of yarn in the loop. And the reason I prefer yarn more than anything is I can trim it down. If you're using a factory-made indicator, whatever, a polystyrene balls, you can't trim them down, cut them down. But if you've got a very, very micro small amount of yarn entrapped within a loop on your fly, your tippet material, you can trim that thing down so small, that any minute indication of movement that the fish has made by taking your fly, you will see. And that's a big mistake big anglers make. Indicators, way, way too big. And the other advantage of yarn, more than anything else over and above what I've said, is that even at extreme ranges, you can see that on the surface because it sits on the surface above it. A lot of indicators sit too low in the surface, and it's very, very difficult for you to visually see and detect a take. More to the point, know that you've got good drift control. The other option I use is double-sided tape. And that's very simple. You just go to Walmart, buy some of that white double-sided tape, and you just have a pair of scissors, and you cut a little tiny slip of that double-sided tape off, and you just roll that around your tippet.
And you're talking about like the foam, kind of the foam double-sided tape?
Yes. Yes, it's white. Yes, foam, white, double-sided tape. Costs you, I don't know, 50 cents for a spool of it.
Lifetime supply, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it's so useful because if you want a micro-small one, you just roll on a little micro-small one. If you want a larger one, you cut a larger piece off and you make a larger one. Same thing, though. It'll sit high on the surface and you can see it. But the most important thing, and I would emphasize, is that when you are fishing micro-small flies, everything's got to be related. And finding down your equipment to 6X to 7X and then putting on a big, bold bubble indicator just totally destroys everything you are aiming to achieve in the first place. But I see it all the time.
Yeah. Good final tip. Well, we got to wrap it up here, Davey, and give away a few prizes here. So we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and we're giving away a copy of your two-DVD set, Midge Magic Fishing and Tying by Fly Fish TV. So stick with me here, Davey, because I'm going to have you help me make sure I get the right answer, the question I'm going to ask here in a few minutes. So hold tight, and we'll be right back to do that and give away some of these things. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org to learn more and to get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners from our drawing are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so that you have a chance at winning one of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show so that we can get the prizes to you. Okay, so the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. The Federation is an international organization for both fresh and salt water, and does a lot of great things for the fly fishing industry. So if you don't win tonight, go join anyway. And let me fire up my computer here and have it pick a random winner here. And it looks like it's going to be Jason Schumacher, in Nevada. So, Jason, congratulations on winning your membership to the Federation. I know you'll enjoy being a member. And if you already are a member, just let me know and we'll get you extended. Now we'll give away a subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And that's courtesy of Amato Books, and you can go to www.amatobooks.com to learn more about periodicals they have as well as the books they have there. Great place, great resource. Looks like our winner there is Matthew Singer from Arkansas, Davey. So you got a homeboy down there that just won, so that's nice.
I know him real well. I've guided him many times.
Oh, have you? Okay, good. Well, yeah. Okay. Congratulations, Matthew, and you'll have to thank Davey in person when you next time you see him.
Yeah, he'll bring me some whiskey.
Yeah, bring me some whiskey. Okay, so now we're going to give away your DVD set here, Midge Magic Fishing and Tying by Fly Fish TV. So let me clear my queue here, and I've got a two-part question here I'm going to ask, Davey. So you make sure that I get the right answers. I'm going to tell you when they answer it. They've got to type them in here. Two things. What does Davey tie? What material does he tie his tippet with? And what are the two weights he keeps in his vest that he uses for everything? What number of weights are they? Okay. What does he tie his tippet with, the material? And what are the two number of weights that he keeps in his vest? Okay. I'm waiting for him to type here, Davey.
Okay.
Do you know the answers to those, Davey?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, good thing, because you're going to be the decider here, if anybody answers. Wow. Okay, boy, Charlie, I think Charlie got it right here. He says amnesia and then number 8 and number 10.
Yes, that's right. Amnesia is what I use for the butt section of my lead assistance off the fly line.
Right.
And
the two weights were 8 and 10,
yes.
Correct? Yep. Okay, so Charles, or Charlie Card from Dutch John, Utah. You just won yourself 2DVD set of Davey's Midge Fishing. And I know there's midge up in the Green River up there, so that should come in real handy. And the water's crystal clear up there, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
That's a tough river to fish. That one's
Yeah, because it sees a lot of angler pressure.
Yeah, a lot. So, Charlie, you need to, you got it all here for me. I got your address, everything. You're good to go. So we'll get that off to you and get Fly Fish TV to send that out to you directly, and you should receive it shortly. Well, Davey, I really appreciate you being with us again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And like I said, you're a thinking fly fisher man that I always learned something from, and makes me want to go out there and think more and do less or think about what I'm doing. Let's put it that way. But thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, that's a pleasure. And one day you should get yourself over here to see the magic of the White River system here in Arkansas.
Yeah. And I'd love to do that. One of these days I'm going to, I think, head south towards Florida and try to hit everything in between, and that'll definitely be one of the stops. So thanks for the invitation.
That's a
pleasure. Hopefully you've all found the archive on our website. If you haven't yet, there's links on our homepage at the bottom of each page. Be sure you check out the archive. We've got over 180 shows in there now, and everything from trout to tarpon and from the White River to the Madison River. And so explore. I know you'll learn a lot. I think we have a couple other shows we did with Davey in there, too. I think this is the third or fourth show I think we've done with Davey. So.
Fourth.
Yeah, so get out there and listen to Davey's other shows. They're great. And if you learn something tonight, I know you'll learn something in those other shows as well. Yeah. Our next broadcast will be on February 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'm going to interview Jeff Currier. And our topic for the show will be Golden Dorado in Bolivia. Jeff has been on another great adventure, this time in Bolivia for Golden Dorado. Dorado have voracious teeth and put up an incredible fight, so listen in to find out how Jeff did and whether he landed his trophy fish. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Motto Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight, as well as Fly Fish TV. So if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.